Jeff, I have to say it really concerns me to have this very confident pilot in a go-fast airplane in weather, in busy airspace, you know, kind of charging into a situation that he's never done before, wondering whether he can do it. That gives me pause, and I just – the thought of him pressing on gravely concerns me.
And I think that's a perfectly valid concern, you know, and that's why I said if you need to mentally reset, if you chose that answer, totally understand. I think this pilot, if he understands his aircraft, if he understands the avionics, and he's got a 10-mile-plus straight leg to slow down before that turn, you know, even in the Lancer, this can totally be done. I was in that situation with that kind of equipment experience. I would do it. I'd engage the autopilot, have it cross, which fixes it there, Vista, have it cross Vista, slow down in a straight line, make sure it's all coupled up, watch it fly the curve. I know what's supposed to happen here, do my descent, and then once I'm past Kanik, I'm back to a known entity, and I don't have to wait. I learn something new, and I complete my mission, and I've got a solid bailout. If I have a problem, just like any time you have a problem on an approach, stay where you need to stay and ask for help. And I don't think I'm going to have to ask for help.
And I'm not suggesting that it can't be done. I just think the probability is really not good for – I mean, how many pilots are ready for this kind of challenge at this point in the situation you've described? I mean, it's almost an incident at least waiting to happen. It's not inherently dangerous to proceed. There's no mountains. You're not, you know, doing something like that. But I just think you're already behind and you really need something to slow you down. Bob?
Well, given what's going on here, this pilot's doing 3.5 miles a minute across the ground. He's, really moving along. There's not a lot of time to think here and analyze the situation. First of all, there's no category E minimums on this approach to start with. Okay?
Agree. He has to slow down.
He needs to chop the power. And considering the things are going to move along very fast, even if he chops the power, I'm in favor of requesting vectors to the final and going with option number 3. I don't think this is the time to try the system out and make a knife-edge turn around this radius here.
I agree with Bob. I think it's a matter of risk-reward. I don't think there's any doubt that we're going to be able to, at some point, get into this airport. You know, it's 902. The approach minimums are well above it. The question is really is how are we going to get to Kanik? Are we going to fly the RNF leg, or are we just going to get a vector to it? And I think the risk-reward doesn't really justify it at this point. The risk is that we're going to mess up and have to come out and be resequenced. The reward is the ego is saying, "Yeah, I did that the first time," you know. So I don't see where it really gets you much.
Well, let me counter that then.
Okay.
Let me put a counter on the table for the exact same thing in terms of risk reward. So you ask for vectors for the approach. Now you're kind of in split attention, right? So you're setting up for the approach. You're listening for vectors. You're getting vectored. Who knows how close he's going to turn you onto this approach, right? Because it's a pretty harried controller. So there's another person in the mix versus I can engage an autopilot. I see exactly where it's going. I see how many miles I have to slow down. And it's not an insubstantial amount. Like there's enough time even for a quick airplane. So now it's all in my purview. It's all in my control. Okay, the plane's going to fly that arc. I got to make sure it's on there. I'll pull back the power. I've got time for this plane to slow down. I know exactly what's going to happen. I can't be vectored back off the approach or across the inbound course or any of these other things that could throw a curveball into the plan. Yeah, so it's in my control. It's sort of like the ability of being vectored onto just like a regular, say, T-style GPS approach versus, look, just give me to one of the fixes on the T, and I plan everything else out from there. I'm in control.
But, and okay, you said that this is adding the controller back in. What was your original plan? Your original plan was to be vectored for the ILS.
Yeah.
Okay. And being vectored for the final or for the Yankee approach is no different than that. So just continue with that plan, and you're really, you know, Yankee is an ILS overlay. And the controller could care less which one you do. He's going to get you to the point out there at the final approach fix, cleared for the approach, goodbye. And let's go try this thing on another day when it's VFR or I got a safety pilot or something like that. That's why I say I just don't see the risk is not great, but right. there is a risk involved in this, and the reward is mainly an ego.
And we differ on the reward. There's ego, but I like being – I actually like this better than being vectored for the ILS. Boom, it's all mine. I come around. I feel great.
Well, that fits the profile of this pilot, macho. Macho.
Did I tell you I'm going out and buying a Lancer?
But why not use all the resources available to you? And the controller is a resource. There is some question of how this is all going to work out. I would rather try it in VFR conditions, not on an IFR flight plan. See how the thing really works, how it functions. Does this GPS steering really work as we think it's going to work? Not the time to do it now. But the macho pilot doing 210 knots might think it is. Okay.
Don't forget he's already used this GPS steering in holds and procedure turns, so he does have some experience with it. So,
well, not on the RF leg.
Not on the RF leg. That is true. But yes, I mean the system. It's not a matter of like wiring or connections or anything. We know the system works.
And let's get real here. I mean, by way of preparation. You know, this guy is going into the airport that he was planning to go into. Do you not look at the approaches, all the approaches, so that you are prepared for all of these options? And, you know, your failure to prepare does not create a crisis for me. I just think this guy, you know, is turning his bad into somebody else's bad. And I just think that's wrong for the system. I don't like what this guy – he may succeed. But what he can do to the system when he doesn't, I just think is, you know, risk reward. Once again, not inherently dangerous, but it could screw up the system, and nobody benefits from that.
Just as you say, a perfect lead in for what I wanted to mention and what I was thinking about is that certainly I train myself and I train my clients. When we contact the final approach controller, we need to know what we want, not what they're going to assign. And when it comes to an ATIS reporting an ILS, if I know that there is an LPV approach that is virtually identical with virtually the exact same minimums, I'm going to request that RNAV approach every time because I don't get scalloping of the needles. And so for me, this pilot was behind before he ever left Santa Barbara, in that perhaps he hadn't reviewed these. He wasn't aware of that fact. And if he was, he should have been prepared to request. And I would have requested vectors for the RNAV Yankee personally.
And how
been done with it.
How big a distraction is it to face the number of questions this guy's asking himself? I mean, he is. There are, you know, real questions. You know, can I, should I, you know, is this going to work? And what is that going to do to him by way of capacity? It is certainly going to be a distraction.
Well, he only has 20 seconds to do this till he gets the Vista at 210 knots.
Yeah. So I think we've agreed, though, that slowing down is key here, too.
Like many of the subscribers in previous scenarios, I like an option five. You know, I want to time out. I want to slow down. I want to catch up with my airplane. I want to look at this approach and say, okay, can I, you know, realistically do it versus I think I can do this, because that's just not fair to the system.
I think this also brings out the point, sort of what Doug has said. We can't just put these new fangled gadgets in our airplane and turn them on and go off flying in the system. It's like checking out in a new airplane almost. You need to get with an experienced CFI who knows that piece of equipment that can give you some guidance, and that would have eliminated this whole problem for this guy.
Yeah, and so that's a key point of this whole scenario and what we like to bring up with these things in general. So RF legs are going to be a fundamental component of the instrument system moving forward. They allow us to do some really cool things. But it's an interesting thing you say, okay, so you got to go out with a CFI who is experienced and knows this. Well, when something like this comes out, there may be like 6 CFIs in the country who are experienced with doing it and your system and make sense in your airplane. And granted, I suppose he goes pretty fast. Maybe he could go find one, but it's not if he survives the trip. But nonetheless, it's not even that simple, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so you get this little pamphlet from Garmin that says, hey, RF legs. Great. Now what? And is there one in my part of the country? It was the first time I see one. I read about it. Maybe I did some training on a simulator. And then 3 months later, I'm coming into Palomar. I'm like, oh, the RF leg. Do I take it? Do I not take it? I haven't practiced this for a while because we don't have them in, say, Indiana or wherever I'm from, right? So it's not even like a nice, simple answer. But nonetheless, it has to somehow become a component of our system.
So 2 points there. In nothing against the Hoosiers, but you know they well, probably really. Do. Yeah, I know. I'm all for the technology, and I think RF legs, like you said, is the way to go. And as you talked about in your response, that has enabled places like Palm Springs and stuff to thread the needle through mountains and to get into places. But what are all those – and what does the Zulu plate say right on it? Authorization required, okay? So if you're flying for an airline, you're flying for somebody who's got this stuff, your first time flying this approach – was not the first time in actual IMC. You flew it in a simulator. You flew it with some sort of formal instruction to this. And I guess that's my only point about this. I think they're great ideas. In fact, the 71-1065, the controller manual, actually has some changes in it now that allows a controller, because of the accuracy of these RF legs, once an aircraft is established on an RF leg, they can discontinue vertical and lateral radar separation because the tracks are separated.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can run simultaneous RF legs to parallel runways as long as both aircraft, and they can discontinue radar separation. Previously, you know, you had 1,000 feet or 3 miles or something. But the key in that also is that big block on the bottom of the approach plate that says special authorization required. And even though we've got the box, we've never used it. I wouldn't do this unless I had at least done one in VFR conditions or with a safety pilot or something like that. You know, just to really know what you're doing here.
Well, not only know what you're doing. My concern is what's the equipment going to do here?
Yeah.
Is something else going to crop up here? Some wrinkle.
Well, I think Jeff offered bailouts for those contingencies.
Yeah, right.
Even if you've done this previously, there's no guarantee the equipment is going to work correctly on this approach. So you still need your bailouts.
Well, let's throw another curve in here and talk about the autopilot. Because, you know, like any other tool, it can help you, it can hurt you. In this airplane, in this situation, you described how it really is maybe a little bit more relevant because of the nature of this airplane. The autopilot really does help almost anybody, you know, simplify and fly the airplane. But once again, even with that, you're approaching the approach differently whether you use the autopilot and the procedures you're going to use versus hand flying and how you're going to get around, you know, this arc.
Another element of the autopilot and the autopilot integration with your navigator. And there's a whole issue there. And Jeff, you brought this up very well in the scenario of the fact that you would have to transfer from GPS roll steering to approach mode. So typically you're going to be, depending on how you pull up GPS steering, if you were 55X, by itself you do nav-nav to get GPS roll steering, then have to hit approach. If you were doing, with my Aspen, I'd have to do heading, GPSS in the Aspen, and then still go to approach if I wanted to get the glide path. And a lot of pilots are not aware of that. And so there's not only the issue of knowing your navigator, but also knowing the integration of your autopilot with the navigator.
And buttonology here.
Right.
And all the proper, exactly, buttonology.
Buttonology and how things are connected sort of behind the panel, where the signal is going and what, you know, is and isn't working. I mean, another good point there is the approach mode usually goes through the HSI. So if you had a failed HSI, what a lot of people don't realize is that may kill your approach mode, but your GPS steering mode still works because it bypasses the HSI. So if you wanted to, you could use your autopilot for lateral guidance in GPS steering on approach and then manually trim the airplane for your vertical, right? So and be using a backup CDI for the approach mode. So, you know, those kind of things can get you out of a situation if you understand how these things work. A lot of people have upgraded from a 55X, you mentioned, to a DFC-90. And I've gone flying with people who don't realize the DFC-90, you could put it in nav mode. It knows it should be in GPS steering mode. It just ignores you. And it uses GPS steering when it should, and then it goes over to approach mode when it should. So, you know, you really need to understand what's working behind the scenes. And accept, I think, as well, that there are situations where the autopilot is just better than we are. These RNAV RNP approaches, the ones that have curving paths to DA, they're not allowed to be hand-flown, some of them. They are flight management system only. And if there's a failure, they're supposed to commence a mist. How they're supposed to commence a mist on a curving path with when it was supposed to be, you know, flight management system only, I'm not quite sure. But the point being, the person doesn't have the required precision that the machine does.
And just, you know, on a personal minimums perspective, every pilot has to answer the question of what conditions do I need before I try something I haven't tried before? And you really need to know that, you know, big picture wise, because literally this is he's facing something he's never faced before. Ideally, you know, you want an instructor there with you and you want to have really prepared in some way to try something you've never done before, as opposed to complex airspace in the weather trying to complete a busy day. It's a question each pilot has to ask himself and have a good answer.